Welcome. New, some new faces into this class.
Where we are in this whole story is the subject today is how devotees should relate to one another. You know, one of the things that we have to really appreciate, which is it feels like a bigger idea than it really is, but once you pick up life from the thread of my internal awareness is really my primary responsibility, and shifting my internal awareness is going to determine everything else that I do, then literally everything else that you do is impacted by it. The Bhagavad Gita states it very dramatically by saying, what is day to the worldly man is night to the yogi, and what is night to the worldly man is day to the yogi. Meaning once you really begin to see life from the inside out, everything becomes the opposite of what it was before. These are not ideas that make newcomers really, really happy, because as a rule, people are not looking to have their lives turned inside out or upside down. But over time, we begin to understand that even though at the beginning it seems like a peculiar shift of consciousness, the more you get used to it, the more you are incredibly grateful every day for what the possibilities of knowing that your experience of life, because it's primarily a matter of your own consciousness, is therefore largely under your own control. Now, of course, the problem is our consciousness is not under our own control. So this is, to a certain extent, a pleasant theory for a long time, but at least it allows us to begin to operate in the direction that is sooner or later going to bring the results that we want. And that's the essential shift that the Bhagavad Gita is talking about. I had a relative in my life, he's long since left the planet, but he and I were good friends. We had a lot of respect for each other. He was, you know, 40 years older than me. Now, as I say, he's off the planet. And we had completely different philosophical ideas. And every discussion that we had would always come down to an essential division point, which we would cheerfully acknowledge and then go on and, you know, do something else. But the division point was simply this. His point of view about life was that the world exists as an objective reality, and that if we're smart, we're going to adapt ourselves to the conditions that we see. He was an ambitious man. He wanted to be wealthy. He worked at a variety of businesses and became pretty well-to-do. He never succeeded on the scale that he'd hoped to succeed. He'd hoped to be an extremely wealthy man. He became merely a well-to-do man. But he did it by a kind of shrewd is almost the right word, but he wasn't really shrewd. He was a very good man. By just kind of observing the world around him, taking the opportunities, doing this business and then doing that business and then this one and that one, and kind of rolling them out as people do, completely with honor, you know, all of the right qualities. My point of view, which I came to before I was 20, which was a revelation for me when it occurred to me, was the fact that if you shift your consciousness, then absolutely everything else is different. That it's all a matter of your perspective. I have to say, to be honest on that, I came through the 60s, and so we shifted our consciousness by means that were not necessarily from inside. But I never went very far that way because I needed one experience. I just needed one experience that just said to me, oh, look at that, change consciousness, change everything. And I didn't really enjoy chemically induced change of consciousness because it felt just murky and confused to me. But one experience showed me change consciousness, change everything. And then for the first time in my life, I felt like I had a grasp on why I was here. It had just been just chaos before that time. Just before some of you came in, Chidambara and I were talking about a friend who turned 28 today and wondering whether we remember 28 or not. I actually remember 28 if I give it a number, like 1977. Then I know exactly where I was and what I was doing. My being 28, I don't remember, but I remember 1977, which was 30, so that would have been 1975, remember exactly. Swami was writing the path, I was typing it for him.
So, I mean, those are things you remember. But everything prior to my coming onto the spiritual path was just pretty much just gray confusion to me. I just kept thinking there was some secret to life and somebody was going to tell me someday. And finally, he did. Swami Kriyananda told me when I was 22, just by his manifestation. But prior to that, I learned this. I learned it first from chemicals, and then I learned it from Vedanta, from philosophy. Change your consciousness, change everything. And so in my discussions with my relative, we would always come to the point where I would start talking about inward transformation, and he would start laughing, and we would just go on to do something else. But to me, and of course this was like in the late 60s, so it was a long time ago, before all of this was so current, not that he would have accepted it even if it had been current. But the point being, once we grasp that anywhere, we have to realize there is no limit to its application. And that's a little challenging. You know, we call this class the spiritual warrior, because what we're talking about here is the serious combat ready understanding of life. Because at the beginning of understanding this possibility that consciousness is the key, we hedge our bets. We sort of think it's sort of the key. So like when we first begin to learn about karma, lots of things are karma except certain things aren't. You know, and the things that are karma are the things that we can comfortably get our minds around, and the things that aren't karma are things that we can't comfortably get our minds around. So we try to say everything in the universe is an interwoven tapestry, a clear, impersonal case of cause and effect, except this isn't. You know, it's like you have a whole woven tapestry and you just take a pair of scissors and you just cut this hole out and don't realize that all those threads connect. You can't just pull that out. But it's not easy. Is not easy, because what it keeps doing is it keeps directing the solution back to ourselves. And I like to blame others. I mean, everyone likes to blame others. It's just much more comfortable. You don't understand me. It's your fault. If you were nicer to me, if you just treated me differently, it's not really that I'm upset. It's that you don't know how to answer me. How many times do people tell you that it really isn't that they're touchy, it's that you're insensitive, right? And then they'll give you a big set of directions about how you're supposed to relate to them. And never considering for a moment that maybe they should change the way they respond to you. But you know, this is just human nature. But when we reach a certain point on the spiritual path, and that's the assumption of this particular class, we're really ready at least to listen with an open mind to the implications of consciousness. And so when Swamiji wrote these notes about how to be a disciple, he's talking to a monastery in which people have left the world to be monks, and they're going to have to live in harmony with one another, and they're going to have to live in such a way that every aspect of their life facilitates their spiritual growth. Now, none of us here have actually entered a formal monastic institution in the way that this group that he's addressing did, or that we understand. You know, the whole idea of really entering into these formal institutions and this group living is an idea whose popularity is just, you know, waning and waning and waning. You go to large monastic settings and you find a handful often of aging monastics there. There's a worldwide movement of consciousness, which is about the yugas, which some of you know about already, just the new age dawning, that's really trying much more to integrate spirituality with everyday life. So we find people who are not even slightly interested in, you know, donning some kind of exotic attire and living in some communal situation with, you know, only members of their own gender. They want families and careers and artistic pursuits, but the spiritual longing is not any less. And what we have to also understand is that the principles of spiritual living are not in any way reduced. It, you know, nothing has changed. Merely because we take our body and our consciousness and put it in one setting or another, the realities of our consciousness are still exactly the same. And they haven't changed ever in human nature. The planet changes, but human nature remains the same. And the problem of our own consciousness is always the same, from incarnation to incarnation, even. Karma is one aspect of it, reincarnation is the other. Reincarnation is an extremely integral part of really understanding how this personal evolution takes place. Adam, you have a question?
I guess I'm just wondering, does that necessarily mean because we're in an ascending age that monastic orders are due for extinction, going to be a thing of the past, necessarily?
Well, no, because the inward desire to live free, the inward realization that external relationships and attachments do not really increase my inner joy, but that my inner joy is greater without personalizing it, is a state of spiritual understanding that that people come to. So it could easily, you know, that aspect of just wanting to live free and love the whole world equally is something that people will want. The necessity to separate yourself out from society as a whole is stronger when society as a whole is really gross. You know, I mean, even just sitting right here, we don't really sort of wander up to the nightclubs of San Francisco and just kind of hang out there. Oh, let's go have dinner, you know, in the most sleazy section of the city where everybody is just drinking and trying to attract other men and women, you know, if we're trying to keep our consciousness elevated. If the whole of the culture is lower in its vibration, then you would have less and less of an inclination to be part of it. I mean, I know this may be obvious to some, but I was just really reflecting recently on the plight of women and how I was looking at a book about Queen Elizabeth and Mary, Queen of Scots, Queen Elizabeth I, and they just kept reiterating in there, you know, women just got pregnant over and over and over again and then often died, either in childbirth or from being worn out. And it was just, that's what a woman was expected to do. You can see how a woman who had a desire to live for God and just didn't want to be the property of some man and the breeding machine of his family would just say, sorry, I'm walking away from this whole thing. And would just, you know, run to a convent and often would have to run away to a convent because otherwise the men in her family owned her. She had no freedom at all. I mean, I'm seeing it from a female point of view. The man's perspective would be a little different, but it would be similar. You're just expected to do these certain things. And if you really don't want to do them, you can't extricate yourself in the middle. Nowadays, women can live single, and it's just perfectly fine. Women have control over, you know, to a certain extent, control over their own reproductive systems. You're definitely not owned by the men in your life. So the necessity to separate yourself that far has been reduced by the gradually elevating nature of society. But that's not speaking to consciousness. That's just speaking how you can have a certain consciousness in certain settings that you really, circumstances wouldn't have allowed you to have that before. Okay? And then plus there's I don't know. Actually, I won't answer beyond that. Swami Kriyananda has started, as you well know, the new renunciate order for the new age, offering, so that implication itself is that the idea of, in fact, it may become more common, the idea of renunciation is more and more people understand what that really means and how to live it. And as the concept of being a renunciate elevates with the times, right now the concept of being a renunciate is still very much in the past picture. You know, absolute obedience, conformity, group consciousness, obedience to the rule, dependence on others, lots of things which are just not attractive. Even if you're deeply dedicated spiritually, you're just not attracted to that. You're specifically not attracted to that because it's a whole different reality. So I think everything transforms together. That's a good question. Okay. So I was speaking of the fact of reincarnation me think how I was speaking of it. Let me just remember for a moment. Oh, yes. The more we recognize that consciousness is everything, the more we recognize that our life experience is determined by our consciousness, the more attentive we become about every piece of it. Then, when you throw into it the idea that you'll just be born again at whatever state of consciousness you're at right now, you realize that there's just no shortcut. You know, you're just right there. It makes you extremely attentive. And it's certainly for me, over the course of years, as the concept of reincarnation has become so integrated into my worldview, that it's just, I don't even hesitate, it's just part of the story, that the inner escape hatches become fewer and fewer, which, depending on your perspective, is either annoying or is profoundly liberating. It's liberating in the sense that, you know you have to do something, you just have to do it. If you're standing in your kitchen and there's all those dirty dishes and there's nobody there to wash them, it doesn't really matter whether you want to or not. They're still going to be there in the morning. You're just going to have to wash them sooner or later. I was in this class just making much of little, but I have a clothesline outside and the clothes are hanging out there. I was just in a mood. I really did not want to take those clothes off the line. Everything annoyed me. Housework annoys me anyway, but it just was really annoying to me. And I just watched myself develop a real aversion to taking those clothes off the line. It was just kind of entertaining, in a sense, to watch it. And I thought, you know, where is this going to take you? How is this going to serve you? How are these clothes going to get off the line if you don't take them down? Believe me, David's never going to take them down. He'll walk back and forth past them 100 times before he'll never take them down, you know. It's just that. So, like, they're going to have to come inside. So, there was no exit. I mean, it's a tiny thing, but at least in my own life, often very tiny examples can exemplify a really big story. You know, here I am carrying resentment at so-and-so or for something or another. You know, what do I think is going to happen? You know, just like, actually, what do I think is going to happen with this resentment? Do you think somebody who doesn't even know you're annoyed with him, what to speak of, doesn't take responsibility for it, because in fact it is your fault, you know, is ever going to like make it right? And what do you imagine they could do that would make it right? You know, what could they say? Oh, poor baby, I was so mean to you. You're such a wonderful person, and now I'm just so sorry. And, you know, it's just like, how is that going to do anything? Like, you still feel it. They still were a chump, so then they, you know, grovel a little more. I mean, at what point is it enough, and when is it okay for you? So part of the really deep, and this is what our lesson is about today, the place in which this comes out absolutely the most is in our relationships with each other. Because we want from each other, we need from each other. This is, as Sri Yukteswar says in The Holy Science, this is a stage on the spiritual path, is the necessity to be in relationship with other people, because the spiritual path is about the purification of the heart. Even when we meditate, we tend to think of meditation as calming the mind. I wrote this in my book about Swami. There's a story about this, which I learned from him. But what makes our mind restless is when our heart is restless, because reason follows feeling. That's one of Yogananda's aphorisms. We tend to think it's not true, but it is true. If we're predisposed emotionally to have a certain point of view, then the mind just supports that point of view. I mean, I'm amazed sometimes, you know, a week or two later, to see some little cycle of something I played out that all started with an emotional bias. And then I just thought I was being so sensible and so helpful, but if I had been able to erase that emotional bias, suddenly a whole other range of responses is open to me. But at the time, the emotional bias was the fish swimming in water. I didn't even know it was there. But reason follows feeling, and we watch it over and over again. That's how very intelligent people can have extremely crazy ideas about things. You know, my husband is not an alcoholic, even though he drinks every single day, because my feeling is terrified to recognize that. So my reason supports all these other things. I mean, when we're in a state of what they call now denial, you're just in it. It's not like you know that you're in it. You're just in it because reason follows feeling. And Swamiji, in talking about, well, the whole story in the book, which is worth saying here, is when I met Swami Kriyananda, he was in his 40s, I was in my early 20s. As I got to know him over the years, I met him in 69, as most of you know. One of the things that just impressed me was how brilliantly intelligent he was. Just on any subject, he still is, he's 85. You know, he just still is. He's just brilliantly intelligent on any subject. And his intelligence is very practical. You know, over many years of working with him, many different situations arise in community life, and how can it be resolved? And he's always able to find a resolution, just when no one else, and very bright people can't, he can. And as soon as he finds it, it's so obvious, but others don't see it. And I really, really contemplated, what is the secret of his intelligence? I was raised in a household where intelligence was prized above all, so it was always a very big value for me. And I realized that the secret of his intelligence did not come from his brain, but it came from his heart. Because his heart was very pure. It was devoid of personal motive, and freed of the necessity to protect himself from truth. You know, we're always trying to protect ourselves from truth, because if we really see that somebody mistreated us, we might have to accept the fact that we deserved it. And we have this terrible fear of being unworthy or being bad or being shamed. I mean, these are very deep things. If somebody does something really terrible to us, we think that we must be, therefore, a very bad person. So we have to protect ourselves from that thought, among many, many other thoughts. We want to protect ourselves from appearing foolish. We have a tremendous fear of failure. We don't want to expose ourselves. We don't want people to know how much we care, how vulnerable our feelings are, what's the secret habits that we have that they don't know. I mean, all these different things that are feeling-oriented that cause us to always have to be a little bit on guard. You know, in the Bible, it says, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. And that comes in the Beatitudes when he's giving the cause and effect of a lot of qualities. Blessed are those who weep, because they'll be comforted. You know, blessed are those who give, they'll be supported, so on and on. But those who have pure hearts will see God. And it seems that when you first read the Beatitudes, you think, wow, that seems like a big reward for that. But it's when you get farther into yoga, meaning the science of self-realization, of how consciousness really works, you really begin to understand what a metaphysical truth he's stating there. Because when the purity of heart means that the heart is not confused by ego-based self-definitions and by ego-based responses to life. Ego, in this context, is the infinite spirit identified with the limited body and all the conditions of the incarnation that you're presently living in. And that's our problem. You know, ego is not, I think I'm a great, important man, I think I'm a terrible, horrible man or woman. It's both of which are just distortions of your true position. Ego is the fact that we identify at all with this limitation. And once we have identified with this limitation, we become intensely vulnerable to what happens to this body, to the relationships that are dependent upon this body, to whether we have money, to whether we have friends, to whether we have somebody to love us, whether somebody we love has betrayed us. All of these things, all of that tension and anxiety comes because we've identified with it. I mean, when something happens to any of you, because many of you I know well, I can feel it, but only to a certain extent. You know, if your body was broken by a car, or when my own husband had a terrible pain in his back when he had a disc out, you know, I mean, I just had to stand there. I could be sympathetic, but I wasn't feeling it like he was feeling it, because he's identified with that body, I'm not. I love that body because I love the spirit inside of it, But he is experiencing it. And, you know, when you do something wrong and you're suffering over it, your friends can sympathize, but you're the one who's identified with it. And that's what makes us so vulnerable. If we just were able to stand back and realize that I am one, I am equal, I am impersonal, that what happens to this one doesn't have to define me in that way. That's where our freedom comes from, and that's what it is to be spiritually advanced, is to have identified ourselves with a greater reality. That phrase comes up in our Sunday ritual a lot, you know, we're part of a greater reality. And when we advance spiritually, it's not like we become less ourselves. It's actually that we just define ourselves in a bigger and bigger context. I mean, in America is an extremely individualistic society. Many of the Asian cultures and many other cultures than this one, this is the most individualistic society, probably one of the most in the world. But many cultures define themselves as they literally identify as much with the family as they do with their own self. This is very hard for Americans to get when you're first exposed to that thinking. But you have to do this for the family. And you make your decisions for the family because your identification has gone from yourself to the family. Some people identify themselves with their nation. Patriotic individuals who become soldiers for patriotism will be it because I identify with my country. And, you know, on and on it can go like that. Spiritually speaking, what we're trying to do is we're trying to identify with the non-physical reality that is ourself. Because our limitation is really defined. It starts with identification with this body. It's very, very interesting to contemplate that. It's a fabulous meditation to contemplate that. How many of the things that I think and experience and do are because I think of myself as defined by this physical body? You can start with your gender, your ethnicity, then your position in life, your relationships with everyone. Because we identify with this body, everything else follows from that. This body is a physical reality that we've stepped into. You know, the sperm and ovum come together, the spark of life is there, we make this body. And we're identified with the body that we're standing in. It used to be a baby's body, it used to be an embryo in a woman's womb. And we were still there. You know, there's a little baby in our community, little Santiago. He's maybe 2 months old now. He's this tiny little person. All his parts are there. He's a tiny little person. He spends most of his time sleeping. But when you look into his eyes, he's there. And I know that as we watch him grow up, and that, you know, 20 years from now, we'll look in his eyes and he'll still be there. So what is he, really? You know, he's that spark of energy. We were just talking about remembering ourselves younger. I actually, even though I say that my life before Ananda was just dim and gray, that's not entirely true. Because I do have memories of myself specifically in many ages. And I'm sure many of you do too. And there's an astonishing self-completeness about those memories, even though you know that you were just a very small person. One of my favorite, you know, memories was when I was 10 and I had taken up with bad companions. And these children were pretty rowdy, but they were much more interesting to me than anybody else. And my parents were really upset. And my personal joke was that I'm the kind of kid my parents don't want me to play with, because I was a little bit more of an instigator than they knew. The fact of the matter is they were not suitable companions for me. If I had been my parents, I would have also been freaked out about it. But I remember declaring to my parents, and this is how I did it because I was always precocious with words. I don't know why I know this, but I've always remembered it. I said, "The die is cast." I said, "I'm either a good kid or a bad kid, and there's nothing you can do about it now." I was 10. You know, I was a torpy little 10, even at that. Can you just see it? But you know what's so interesting? I knew it was true. You know, I declare it now and it makes me laugh. Just the picture of myself saying that, my parents must have had such trouble keeping a straight face to have me talk like that. But I knew it was true. I had a very strong sense that I was who I was, and I was living with them and they controlled me, and I had a fine relationship with them, understand, and they were good people. But I was myself, and myself really had nothing to do with them. Just didn't, because we are ourselves. What do we identify with? I was in a kid body, but I was identified already with a larger reality, which was the time before and the time now and the time coming. That's sort of why I say I kind of just hung out until I met Swami, because, you know, spiritual life was my destiny, so I was just looking for it. And when I found it, I locked into it, and then that was what my real reality was, and that's where I've been. But what I'm saying about all of that is what we're doing on the spiritual path is we're identifying with a greater reality. And as I started this discussion today, when you really deeply understand that that's your objective, your behavior has to change. And it doesn't change because somebody's putting rules on you, and it doesn't change because your priest is standing there telling you you'll go to hell or alternately to heaven if you behave in these certain ways. It changes because you yourself perceive everything differently. And the way we respond to life is simply how we perceive it. We can be forced into certain ways of behavior by people who have power over us, or by our own fears, or by the rules of society, all of these certain things. But what we're really working with here is that, I lost that train of thought. Oh, it doesn't do any good, is what I was trying to say, to behave in a certain way merely because you have these external realities that are forcing you to do it. What real spirituality is about, that's what I was saying. You know, some concepts of religion are all about how you behave. And partly the discussion of monasticism as it has come down to us through the lower ages that we're just leaving is very much about how you behave. You know, you put your hands in your sleeves and you always keep your eyes down and you always speak in a soft voice and you move in a certain way and all that sort of thing. But that doesn't matter. What's happening is inside your consciousness. So what real spiritual life is how you perceive the world. What do you really think is true? What do we really think is true? Where do we think our happiness comes from? And then, which brings us, as it always does, I can spend 45 minutes getting to the first word. The first word of this section is, Sri Yukteswar, who was Yogananda's guru, said, you have to learn to behave. And it's very interesting, because Autobiography of a Yogi, which is Yogananda's seminal book, for those of you who are newer, if you haven't read it, I highly encourage you, do buy the blue version, which you can get in our bookstore. There's an orange version. Do not buy the orange version. Buy the blue version. The blue version is the unedited words of the master. The orange version is edited a great deal, and it's not as good. But in that book, Yogananda, I mean, it's, you know, just a few hundred pages, and he wrote it in 1948, and it's essentially it helped launch and continues to inspire a spiritual revolution in this country. It's still the best-selling autobiography, you know, 60 years after its publication. But he tells stories about his own training with his guru. So every line of that book is carefully chosen. And one of the instructions that Sri Yukteswar gave to Yogananda when he was training him was, learn to behave. And it seems like, here's Sri Yukteswar, he's this tremendously powerful guru. He's giving Yogananda experiences of cosmic consciousness. He's resurrecting himself from the dead and describing the astral world. I mean, it's just so far out. But then also written in there is learn to behave. Because even though all those extraordinary levels of perception and experience are where we're going and will inevitably be part of our reality, if not today, tomorrow. It's really quite amazing to contemplate that, you know, sooner or later, we'll be standing there with the best of them, because that's just our inevitable destiny. But how do we get there? One of the ways we get there is we learn to behave. And we learn to behave according to the rules of right consciousness, not merely according to the rules of social behavior. As somewhere in here he says, good manners without sincerity are like a beautiful dead lady, is how Sri Yukteswar describes him. Then he says, straightforwardness without civility is like a surgeon's knife, effective but unpleasant. And then he says, candor with courtesy is helpful and admirable. I mean, he's just summing up the whole, you know, the whole potentiality of human conversation right there. But it's not so much for social reasons that we have to learn to behave, but that if we have right consciousness, then right behavior follows as an inevitable consequence of that. And when we misbehave, it inevitably alerts us to the fact that there's some error in our consciousness. Yes, Michael has a question. Do you want to pass that to him?
Thank you. Is there then a role, or I guess a relationship to right behavior leading to right consciousness, in that, I guess, like a child, you know, they are rule-bound, and they are not told at seven to live as you feel.
Yes.
So, and I know for me, I sometimes have learned service because that was an obligation, and I think I loved it in the act of doing, but the doing came first, and the obedience came first. So how does that relationship?
Right. Well, you're exactly accurate. If you do the right thing, it will teach you by the experience of doing the right thing that you want to do the right thing. Even if your first reason for doing it is because it's compelled from the outside, if you're being guided wisely, then you will be compelled from the outside by those who are wiser than you to do those things that will give you the experience that will then motivate you to do it, because the experience itself becomes your teacher. Swami Kriyananda demonstrated this to a mother in our community when he was taking portraits of people in the community. He wanted to take a portrait of this couple and their three children. They're a very attractive family. And the youngest child was a boy. He was about five, maybe. And he simply refused to come out from under the bed. He just wasn't going to. And the mother was doing everything she could to get him out from under the bed. And Swamiji just leaned over and said, if you let me take your picture, I'll give you some Swiss chocolate. And the child came running out. And the child at that time in his life, he's grown past it, was what we call Vaishya. He was very, I'll do it if there's something in it for me. You know, no amount of the family wants you to have this, we need this portrait, be a good boy for mommy. Nothing. Give him something he wanted and he would do the right thing. And so Swami was also demonstrating, this child has this consciousness. If there's something in it for him, he'll behave properly. So train him according to what motivates him. But then, because he was not a gross person, he began to realize that it was really more fun to do the right thing. But he would never have known that if he hadn't been drawn into it, in this case by self-interest. You know, some children have to be some people need to be motivated by threat of punishment, and some, conceivably in your case, you have a certain amount of idealism, and even though you're skeptical, you'll go forward, and then the experience will awaken it in you. And in fact, in the Holy Science, Sri Yukteswar's book, is it in there? I think it's in there. But it's also in a number of other places, where Swami Kriyananda writes that in the evolution of consciousness, each stage of understanding, self-interest being one, threat of punishment being another, motivated by ideals is another, Every individual needs to be relating to those who are just above them. Because if you're relating to those who are just above you, they will emulate, they will exemplify for you the behavior that you're just about to come into. And they'll help you get into that. If you're completely self-interested, you probably really can't benefit that much from the company of saints. You know, maybe just a little bit, but you won't really be able to relate to that kind of selfless reality. That's not your next step. If you're self-interested, what you want to get into is that service is also very pleasurable. And if service is very enjoyable, just, you know, it's sometimes a greater satisfaction to see how much they enjoy it than it is just for me to enjoy it. That's kind of the next step up from pure self-interest. A friend of mine who's a ballet dancer. He was a principal dancer for several major companies. He said, when his personal career was over and he started teaching, he said, I thought the greatest thrill in my life was to dance. He said, but I actually think it's more thrilling to help others to dance. You know, it was just like he just moved up to the next stage and really saw that. that it was still self-interest in the sense of expanded awareness, but he learned it. He was forced to do it by the circumstances of life and then discovered something in it that he didn't know was there. Did that, I've lost a little bit of the connection with your question, so was that what you asked? Okay. Let me think about it just for a moment. Oh, I was going to just tell this one story about Swamiji and then we'll take a break. This is the difference between consciousness and right attitude. I met Swami when I was 24, and I worked closely with him, especially during those early years. And I was outspoken, overconfident in my own opinion, and wrong most of the time. But he was very respectful, and he saw that I had the potential to become less of an idiot if he trained me properly. So he was very, always very respectful. Absurdly respectful is what I would actually say in retrospect, and very supportive because, you know, he had a really long-distance view of this. When I gradually came into the position of leadership that I have here and became of an age where I now have friends and colleagues and co-workers who are of the age that I was when I was working with Swami and of the age gap and greater than I have with him, I began to watch the temptation in myself to use the fact that I'm more experienced and I'm older as a reason why don't you just be quiet and do what I say? Or as an inclination toward impatience with allowing other people to figure out for themselves where they should go. And I have given in to that, but I recognize that that's not right behavior. And one of the reasons that I try not to do it is because when I began to reflect on it, which it took me, of course, a certain perspective to reflect on it, I realized that not once in 40 years of association with Swamiji has he ever said to me either, you're so young, you're too young, you're not young enough to understand, you're not old enough to understand, nor has he said, I don't have enough experience to know. He's just treated whatever I said on its own terms and never took a short way out of it, you know, never used position or power or anything. So I was extremely impressed because suddenly being in the same position, I felt a certain temptation, which I would have to resist and I'd have to sink myself back into a more, less ego-based way of thinking. So I went to Swamiji when I saw him sometime after this revelation came to me. And I said to him, sir, I just want to thank you. In all these years, you never once mentioned my age. That's what I said at first like that. And he sort of, you know, appreciated the sentiment that I was saying, but I could see the slight look of puzzlement on his face almost. And then he just said, well, I never noticed. Just like that. He said, nobody's an age. He said, just your body is an age. All the soul is ageless. He said, in that same context, in another context, when we were talking about the color of someone's eyes, and there was this peculiar situation where this woman who'd been married to this man for several years was shopping for him, and I mentioned, oh, that shirt would look nice. It matches his eyes. She said she didn't know what color his eyes were. And then when they got divorced, I mentioned this. It seemed really odd to me. Swami, again, had that certain look on his face. He said, I never notice what color people's eyes are. He said, I don't look at their eyes, I look through their eyes, into their consciousness. And then he looked at this woman who's been his close associate for, at that point, you know, 35 or 40 years, and she has these huge brown eyes. He said, oh, you have brown eyes. I mean, and then, okay, that, but all of that combined, what I realized is, I'm trying to learn to behave. But what he has done is transformed his consciousness. So even if we're trying to learn to behave, we need to try to learn to behave because we have understood from the inside a new reality. So it's not like I'm just trying to do the right thing because it's the right thing to do or because it'll get me what I want. This man came to Swamiji who was in a leadership position. He'd been reading books and He said, you know, I read here that if you really have to correct someone, before you correct them, you should say two things that you really like about them. So let me listen for a moment. And he said, but that's so manipulative. And then he said, and a sensitive person will see through it right away. You know? And it's like, okay, that's an advancement from not even considering what the other person's reality is. But right consciousness is very different than that. So we not only want to behave properly, we want to behave properly because we have shifted our consciousness. And even as we decide what's right, we decide it from the point of view of right consciousness, which also we have to understand, and we'll go into this in a moment, is a very individual matter. Because it's a question of intuition in the moment. It's not just a question of this is what we always do, but this is what's appropriate in this moment. Sri Yukteswar mentions that too. He says, you know, you must learn to intuit behind the confusion of what men say, what their actual meaning is. I think about that a lot because I often misunderstand people and they often misunderstand me. But that's about consciousness. That's not just about listening. That's about really being able to intuit. So there's all kinds of factors here. So let's take a break. I should say there's a very good chance, I'm only being equivocal for no reason, I'm probably going to take a sabbatical from teaching November, December, and January because I have this book I have to write on miracles and answered prayers. And it's surprising how much teaching makes it hard to write. I remember I have the giant sum of one book that I've created, but I was amazed when I was writing that book that when I stopped teaching every week, what a difference it made. You just don't think it would, but it takes a certain amount of the same energy. Plus, as I was explaining to some people, when you do this, it commits your whole consciousness, and then you kind of lose the connection with the other creative project. So it's almost like you just have to keep the creativity hooked in there. We were coming into the holiday season, which things slowed down anyway, so I'll give it a try. That's my present plan, and there's really no reason for me not to say that is my plan, except that I enjoy these classes, and I am extremely reluctant to give them up. But that's what is probably going to happen. Starting in November, whenever November comes, I'm going to go away on the 23rd of October for 12 days to try to really get into writing. So actually that would mean that I would stop in the last week of October, come to think of it, but then I wouldn't resume again. I might resume in January, depends how the book is going at that point, but I likely won't resume till February. Okay. I'm sad about it. I hope you are not overjoyed, but it's just temporary. Okay, so now, do we have any questions or thoughts or comments? Okay, if not, then let's go forward. Now, where are we? Oh, I was talking about all of that was by way of introduction to then begin to start talking about, you know, how we really want to be. The first thing that Swami warns us about, which is just too self-evident, but we all have to know it, which is how much damage we all do with our words. So the first rule of understanding of the spiritual path is just to have a little more self-restraint. There's a progression in the development of consciousness, which always has to be articulated so we'll really understand. To be suppressed is not the same thing as to be self-disciplined. To be suppressed is that there are it's impurities in the heart, it's anxieties and fears, the inability to face certain situations, the having allowed your life to be dictated by other people or by conditions, being divided against yourself, having qualities in you that you're ashamed of, or that you don't know how to deal with. And so as a consequence of that, suppression is when we're always censoring our own reality. We're just never able to just have an experience and let it be what it is. We're always analyzing it and deciding what's acceptable and what's not. And the difficulty with suppression also is that a great deal of it happens before it reaches the conscious level. So it becomes habitual to just not allow our energy to flow. A lot of times if you listen sensitively to the sound of people's voices, you can hear when there's just a certain amount of tension that's just holding everything in place because of anxiety about what might happen if it comes forward. A lot of times people get very confused on the spiritual path between suppression and self-discipline. And apparently that's always been true, because in the Bhagavad Gita, which is a pretty ancient scripture and a pretty fundamental scripture, there's a dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna, and Krishna says to Arjuna, the phrase exactly is, what will it avail you to suppress your energy? It's not going to give you what you want, because suppression is not freedom. Suppression is not purity. You know, when we talk about the right consciousness, the consciousness that we want to have is that we want to be free. Now, people tend to think that freedom is self-indulgence. I mean, they define, you know, I want to be free, which means I want to do whatever I want. I want to be free of the karmic law. I want to be free of the nature of my own consciousness. I want to just follow all my desires. That's not freedom, that's bondage. If you're compelled by your desires, you're the exact opposite of free. You're always having to do things because you can't restrain yourself. Freedom is the ability to choose. To just consciously and deliberately, with your own awareness fully intact, to decide what you're going to do. To be able to determine what's appropriate and to follow that behavior. So it doesn't have a particular form. Suppression sort of tells you, I have to be this way. You know, I can't speak up in this company. I have to just go along with this. I could never let anyone know that I feel like this. That's not freedom. That's suppression. And as Swamiji says, suppressed energy just reemerges someplace else later. And when it comes out, it's all disconnected from the original cause, and it just creates endless confusion. So it really, that's where Krishna says, what good is it going to do you? It's not really going to make you free. It's just going to make you ever more confused. So at the same time, on the spiritual path, we start talking about, you know, certain ways that we should behave, which all have to do with not giving undue emphasis or importance to our own selves. But when we're very, very suppressed, we also may not give emphasis to ourself. But it's because we are afraid to, or because we're convinced that we're worthless. But the actual reality is that we're very involved with ourselves. We're very limited in our potential because we're so self-concerned. True freedom is to be unconcerned about oneself. So, therefore, I mean, coming back to what I was saying earlier about what is right behavior is not determined by external definition so much as by your consciousness. So if, for example, your consciousness is profoundly suppressed, then right behavior for you may be very different from a person whose energy is not suppressed. There was let me think how I can say this. I don't know if this was an Edgar Cayce reading or where this came from, but there was this woman who was she was a very promiscuous woman, and she just couldn't help herself. She was just always, it was one man after another, and even when she wanted to be different, she just could not find out how to be different. And finally, and this is a true story, I don't know whether it was Edgar Cayce or she just went to some psychic person who was able to perceive past lives. But when she went to them in despair over this problem that she had, the psychic person said to her, well, in a previous incarnation, you were the mother superior of a convent, and you were extremely judgmental. You know, you were always judging people for not being able to be what you thought they should be. So you, to balance that karma, you had to be in a position where your own behavior was completely beyond your control, and still you can imagine from her past life, you know, how she judged herself in that situation. Well, it doesn't really look like progress, but it wasn't backward either. It was a necessary stage for her to go through. I was remembering a joke. This is actually a woman said this. In one incarnation, This actually happened. This woman was told that in one incarnation she'd been a nun, and the other she'd been a prostitute, and now this woman herself was a psychic person. She could see people on the other side. So she had been a nun in one life and a prostitute in another, and now she was a happy medium. I love that. But depending what you're trying to balance is what is often what will determine how you should behave. I've told this story several times. I was just reading it again myself, the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. You know, one disciple coming, Sri Ramakrishna lived on the Ganges in Calcutta in the 1800s, and his disciples would often take a boat from the city of Calcutta because he lived a little out of town. And it was a ferry. And, you know, one man, he heard people insulting Sri Ramakrishna, and he became enraged. And when he arrived, the guru said to him, "What do you care what those fools say? Keep your own peace. It's not seemly for a disciple of mine to behave like such a bully." And then another man comes across, and somebody else was saying unkind things about Sri Ramakrishna, and the man just sat there. And when he got to the dock, Sri Ramakrishna says to him, he was weeping, he says, "You just let them speak that way about me, and you say nothing in my defense." So it just entirely depends on which way is freedom, which way is into center, which way is right consciousness. One man was a hothead, and he just really needed to learn to restrain himself. The other man was a coward, and he needed to learn to speak up. So we have to ask ourselves, you know, who am I really, and what is right balance for me? And that's what right behavior is. And sometimes we go through periods of time. But when we finally, and this is sort of what I was saying as a preliminary thing, once you reach a certain point of ego health, where, of course, all of us are trapped to a certain extent still, of course, and we have to have a tremendous respect for delusion, but we reach a certain point of ego health where we essentially know who we are, we know our fundamental systems, you know, then we have to start really thinking in terms of disciplining our consciousness into right behavior. And then right behavior always has to do with that which promotes harmony among others, that which promotes harmony in myself, that which is loyal to truth, that which is loyal to Dharma. Dharma is those actions which take us toward higher consciousness. And it's not just what's Dharma for me, but what's going to help the whole group. And this is where then Swami starts talking to us, you know, in the hermitage there. And he comments, and this is one of the factors also in Ananda. We've recently re-articulated what it means to be part of this group, which we talk about, you're being a member of the community for self-realization. And being a member of a community for self-realization means that you have joined your energies with those of your fellow devotees for the collective purpose of all of us helping one another to come to a state of higher consciousness. It's not about dogmas or organizations or anything. It's about this community of individuals joining together. And one of the aspects of that community is that we have committed relationships with each other. We're not just sort of coming and going. We really feel that we have a divine connectedness, that we are brought together as souls for a real purpose, and that we really have a responsibility to help one another and over the long haul. And the opportunity of those relationships, which are acted out through the Sangha and through our residential communities also, is what Swami calls a laboratory for right living. Because you really get to know people well on a much deeper than just egoic level. And you also get to observe people and learn not only from your own experiences, but you get to learn from everybody else's experiences. You get to understand, you know, what attitudes work, what attitudes don't work, you know, what decisions bring what results. And so you really get to... It's an extraordinary blessing not only to be on the spiritual path yourself, but to be on the spiritual path in company with other people who share your ideals. This is something that we feel very passionate about, because after many years of being part of community and helping others on the spiritual path, you know, many of us have really come to understand that even though your relationship with God is individual, it's very hard to make it on your own. In fact, I would say it's impossible. You just really need the help of other people and the mirror of their experience to help you. So when we approach spiritual life, especially if we're, you know, really committed to a spiritual path, which we're talking here, and have the, therefore the opportunity to be in interaction with others, we really have to take seriously the spiritual potential of these relationships. So Swamiji starts saying here, you know, we have to, the more you can simplify, how he's saying is what he's trying to say and what he does give us here is, you know, what is the single overarching best principle to follow? And he talks about loving each other, having respect for each other, which are both good ideas. But then he offers here the most simple thing, the most important rule to remember and the most helpful guideline is to think in terms of serving one another. It's a very interesting and just a simple and a lovely thought. Many, many conundrums about how to behave with other people become clarified if your guiding principle is how can I serve you, which is to say, how can I help you? You know, a very common thing is sometimes people have something they really want to tell someone, and I was helping to try to arbitrate between a mother and a daughter, and the mother had all these things she wanted to tell her daughter. And I said, but she's not interested. You know, who are you serving? Well, she ought to be interested. She should listen to me. But she's not listening. And she's not going to listen. She is totally non-receptive to what you're saying. So by continuing to say it to her, when she's not at all interested or willing to hear it, who are you serving? Of course, what she was serving was her own agitated heart that just needed to keep pounding against the closed door. You know, what makes us stupid? What makes us stupid is that reason follows feeling. Feeling is a panicked idea that if my daughter doesn't do exactly what I want her to do, then something awful's going to happen. So the heart's so agitated, the daughter isn't listening, so the mother just says it more and more and more. She's not going to listen to me once. I'll say it 500 times and then see what happens. You know, let's just keep doing the same thing and see if we get a different result. No, not likely. Who are we serving? It's a very, and with Swami Kriyananda over the many years, I was just thinking about this morning. His patience is just stunning because he doesn't have a personal motivation. His heart is still. That's the secret of his intelligence. So therefore, he doesn't need anybody to be different because it doesn't frighten him for people to live out their own karma. Whereas it frightens lots of us to have other people live out their own karma, doesn't it? We get very, very nervous. We get nervous about our karma. We get nervous about everybody else's. So we're always rushing around trying to make them be different. You know, because who are we serving? I remember a woman friend of mine who was a natural healer, and this was a number of years ago. I was all caught up in this sort of feeling confusion and I sort of described to her how I was feeling at that time. And just so sweetly, she said, and so how is that serving you? Just like that. In other words, what are you getting out of this? You know, I was projecting it out that the whole world was doing all these things to me, but so how is this helping you? And as soon as she said that, I realized I could see exactly how I was smoke screening what was really going on in me. This was really working for me because as long as I stayed in this state of mind, I didn't really have to deal with the real issue. As long as a mother just keeps yelling at her daughter, she doesn't have to deal with her actual fear. She doesn't have to deal with the fact that the child has his own reality. She doesn't have to face the fact that the child's beyond her ability to control anymore. A young friend of mine, younger friend of mine, he was about 18 or 19, he was complaining about his mother being over-anxious and over-protective and always concerned that he wasn't thinking things out enough and that he didn't recognize the consequences of his own behavior. And And in fact, he was reckless and unconscious about a number of things. I had to say it honestly. But he said to me, he said, she doesn't understand that I have the creativity and the energy to deal with the problem. She doesn't, but I do. Because he was a young man. So, you know, if everything crashed around him, he didn't even mind that much. It was just part of the energy of life, you know, and the excitement of being young. And when he said that to me, I had another one of those moments. I remembered being 18, almost 19. And my father, who was, you know, essentially I left home at that point. I'd gone to college and come back. And then that was the transition in which I actually moved out of the house and never moved back. And he could see that the job I had wasn't going to pay the rent, or if it paid the rent, it wasn't going to pay for the car. You know, I mean, it was just like, it was pretty simple math to see that it wasn't going to work. I was not at all interested in any of those facts. None of it mattered. Even if it was true, it didn't matter. It was exactly the same relationship, because I could feel that I was 19 years old. I had so much vitality, and I had friends, I had possibilities, I was up for adventures, you know. Of course, he was also afraid that if I crashed and burned, he'd have to pick up the pieces, you know. And it wasn't like, you know, he loved me. It wasn't like it was a bad thing, but he was in his reality. He wasn't in my reality. And a lot of times we think we're serving, but we're actually trying to serve our concept of their reality and not really their reality. And that's, you know, if we're really trying to serve people, we have to help them go where they are trying to go, which of course takes a degree of inner stillness, what to speak of selfless courage, to be able actually to see where they want to go. And it may turn out that you have nothing to say. I mean, there are certain people in my life that I don't really talk to very much anymore, because they're trying to go someplace that I'm not particularly interested in, and I have no way of knowing. I don't even know how to help them get there. You know, it's not that I don't wish them well. It's just not my reality, so there's nothing I can do about it. But to be able to really serve someone means that you have to understand it from inside their eyes. You have to really stand inside their consciousness and see what's next for them. When I was, years ago, a few times we did these couples retreats, and one of the exercises we really encouraged couples to do with each other is really look at your partner and try to really see your partner as not you. It's just like, Chittambar actually said to me once, it was a very well-phrased, I think when I came to him once because I was really annoyed about David having done something. And Chittambar, seeing where the fault truly lay, said to me, it's easy to begin to think of your partner as just an extension of your own mind, which I have never forgotten, because sometimes I really do see that. I forget how powerfully individual David is, my husband. He's not an extension of my own mind, not at all. He really exists all on his own. And sometimes it sounds funny, but you live with someone for 30 years, you forget that they walk away from you and have an entire reality that has nothing to do with you. I mean, I live my life all the time, and I'm, you know, you're when you've been partnered with someone for such a long time, there's an aura. And it's not like you ever really outside their aura. But at the same time, one lives on a very powerfully individualistic way, if you're, you know, the kind of people that we are. And every so often I realize, oh, so does he. Doesn't that sound silly? But it's true. Imagine how it is. I mean, some of you have children. Of course, it's the same for your children, especially your cute little itty-bitty children who are now great big grown-ups who just really have, they really move completely without you. And who are we serving? Who are we helping? Because love is given, even respect is given, but who are we serving? It's very fascinating, and we will continue. So, that's it for tonight. Okay? Thank you all for coming.